Previously on Flying the Line. Amid the newly deregulated airline environment, ALPA President Hank Duffy struggles to keep ALPA's larger pilot groups from going independent.
This podcast is brought to you by the Airline Pilots Association. ALPA supports its pilots through a variety of resources, including Cleared to Dream, the association's outreach to the next generation of pilots. With age-appropriate information for elementary school through high school, Clear to Dream provides support and resources for future ALPA members of all ages. Visit www.cleartodream.org.
Welcome to the Flying the Line podcast, a look into the past of the Airline Pilots Association, abridged from the book Flying the Line, Volume 2, by George E. Hopkins. Chapter 18, Lorenzo's Last Gamble, The Origins of the Eastern Strike, Part 2. Hank Duffy was determined that ALPA would survive, speaking with one voice into the 21st century. At times he could be very tough, but like O'Donnell after deregulation, his power was stronger when dealing with smaller pilot groups than with the larger ones. Duffy would impose a trusteeship during the Air Wisconsin-Mississippi Valley merger dispute, much as O'Donnell had done to the Frontier pilots in 1978. But if the pilots of a megacarrier insisted upon doing things their own way, even in violation of ALPA policy, Duffy had, like O'Donnell after 1978, recourse only to turn to conciliation and persuasion rather than arbitrary force to make his case. As we have seen, after a rocky start that saw Piedmont's pilots sign away major contract provisions through side letters, Duffy engineered a new collective bargaining system that subjected negotiations for each airline to the direct supervision of ALPA's national officers. The savage impact of mergers, notably Northwest Republic, caused Duffy serious trouble. Northwest had no B scale before the merger, while Republic did. The pilots of Northwest were determined to grant their management a B scale, and if Duffy had resisted, they might well have withdrawn from ALPA. The newly merged Northwest, by now one of the Big Four, was certainly capable of standing alone. Duffy recalled lobbying them, trying to get them to hold their ground against signing any kind of a B scale, but to him, it wasn't the kind of thing ALPA could draw the line on, because the terms were better than anybody else's B scale. Duffy made a plausible argument. Even presidents of the United States, with all the raw power of military might at their command, are prone to note in their memoirs that the power to persuade, the fact that opponents have to listen, gives them their real influence. Duffy believed that the kind of conciliatory, consensus-building approach he had no choice but to embrace might have worked as well for ALPA in the past as it must in the future. But the biggest problem Duffy faced was Frank Lorenzo. Regardless of the body check United's pilots had dealt copycats like Dick Ferris, or the fact that other airline executives seemed less eager to follow his example, nothing ALPA or Hank Duffy could have done would likely have dissuaded Lorenzo from the course of action he had embarked on. His modus operandi was established in the mid-1970s at Texas International, and it never really changed. Lorenzo was a one-trick pony, carrying a load of junk bond debt that typified everything that was wrong with deregulation and the corporate greed that ensued. The biggest historical question, which will always haunt the Eastern Strike, is why any government would allow a man with Lorenzo's reputation to acquire such a respected and venerable airline in the first place. After all, Lorenzo was operating Continental under protection of the bankruptcy laws, thus, in a de facto sense, competing unfairly with other airlines that were paying their bills. In the old deregulated system, the former Civil Aeronautics Board would surely never have allowed a man of Lorenzo's reputation to take on another airline. Even under deregulation, Lorenzo's acquisition of Eastern was so fraught with antitrust and conflict of interest problems that any Department of Justice should have disallowed it. But ideological conservatism notwithstanding, Lorenzo's careful cultivation of the Reagan administration insulated him from such scrutiny. These larger issues aside, the specific question that will always haunt Eastern's pilots is, why did Lorenzo do what he did? The answer lies in his history, and perhaps in the adage that a leopard never changes his spots. At TXI and Continental, Lorenzo first attacked the mechanics, provoked strikes, and then tried to manipulate his pilots into breaking them for him. His plan did not work, but because he had won the subsequent strikes anyway, he was sure to try it again at Eastern. Before the strikes on each airline, the pilots, in saving their jobs, would have done almost anything to accommodate Lorenzo. In 1978, during Lorenzo's attempt to acquire National Airlines from Louis Maytag, Newsweek cited a veteran pilot who complained that almost anyone would be better than Maytag. Incredibly, the International Association of Machinists local newsletter encouraged Lorenzo with the following headline, "Take us, we're yours." That willingness to give Lorenzo the benefit of the doubt never really changed. Even Eastern's unions were cooperative at first. Lorenzo acquired Eastern through a fluke. It happened in February 1986, when a gamble by Frank Borman to coerce Eastern's unions into concessions, including a B scale for new hire pilots, went badly awry. In late 1985, Borman had tried to bluff the pilots by threatening to sell the airline to Lorenzo if they did not grant concessions. Eastern's pilot group responded by taking a strike vote, which passed by a 96% margin. But more troubling than that, Borman's bluff stirred up the outside members of Eastern's board of directors. These directors, whose fiduciary responsibility required them to consider any reasonable offer for the troubled airline, insisted that Lorenzo be allowed to bid. Lorenzo was clearly surprised that he was being taken seriously, given that he was running a bankrupt airline under Chapter 11 rules at the time. He seized the chance and put together a financial package consisting mostly of junk bonds. Then, he waited for the mouse to fall into his trap. With ALPA's strike deadline exerting pressure, Borman, who had no intention of selling Eastern, responded by pushing his bluff to a higher level. Probably at his urging, Eastern's creditors announced a February 28th deadline for the unions to make concessions, or they would foreclose on $2.5 billion in loans. Such a move would force the airline into bankruptcy, with potentially catastrophic consequences for existing union contracts, and the possibility of Lorenzo grabbing control anyway. Lorenzo had led a charmed life under the bankruptcy laws, and he had excellent financial connections to noted junk bond kings and future felons. Deregulation of the savings and loan industry helped pave the way for looters like Michael Milken, who channeled that money to Lorenzo, letting taxpayers take all the risks. The savings of ordinary people, invested by corrupt or incompetent savings and loan managers in Milken's junk bonds, provided the capital that allowed the likes of Lorenzo to flourish. Exasperated with Borman, whom they had made hefty concessions to in 1983, only to watch him turn around and give the machinists a raise, Eastern's pilots were worried and suspicious. Under MEC Chair Augie Gorse, Eastern's pilots had granted Borman $100 million in deferred pay raises, increased flying time, and reduced vacations. By 1986, the MEC was bitterly divided between two strong polar opposites, Chair Larry Schulte, a moderate who wanted to help Borman despite his previous missteps, and Charles Copeland, a veteran New York-based ALPA activist who was militantly opposed. Arguing that concessions were the only way to ensure that Lorenzo would not take over their airline, Schulte got the MEC to agree by the barest of margins to a new contract. The selling of Eastern during the early morning hours of February 24, 1986, was a cathartic moment. Betrayed by IAM leader Charlie Bryan, undercut by some of Borman's own subordinates, who preferred their chances in a reorganized airline, and outmaneuvered by Lorenzo, Borman was an emotional wreck. He was 57, had invested nearly 12 years in Eastern, and had little likelihood of future employment in the industry. Borman had fought desperately to cap his career by saving Eastern, thereby linking his name with such legendary giants as Eddie Rickenbacker. Eastern's pilots had also invested a lot in Borman, both in emotions and givebacks, and his failure was also theirs. Schulte at one point had to be restrained from a fistfight with an Eastern executive, gloating over Borman's fall. The next day, Duffy talked Borman into formally signing the new contract that Schulte had hammered out, which granted a B scale plus $150 million in concessions. Schulte and Borman ratified the agreement before the MEC, then embraced, crying. The MEC gave them a standing ovation. Borman gave Eastern's pilots what protection he could against Lorenzo by signing the new contract. Lorenzo, delighted that this prize had fallen into his lap for such a pittance, promptly announced that he would accept the pilot's contract. He denied any union-busting intentions and agreed to a breakfast meeting with Duffy the next morning. The meeting went well. Lorenzo vowed to let bygones be bygones. Duffy promised that ALPA stood ready, as always, to help anybody, even Frank Lorenzo, make an airline work. In the interim, the employees, while they allowed Lorenzo a chance, saw no reason not to try to find an employer who was more suitable, a white knight. To this end, over the next 2 years, Eastern's unions, operating through the Eastern Employees Acquisition Corporation, approached a wide variety of movers and shakers about supplanting Lorenzo. They talked to former baseball commissioner Peter Ueberroth, Dallas billionaire Ross Perot, Denver mogul Marvin Davis, and corporate raider T. Boone Pickens, among others. Also, because Eastern's unions had substantial stock holdings from the 1984 cooperation plan, they were simultaneously exploring an employee stock ownership plan, or ESOP, by which they could become their own bosses. All these efforts failed for one of two reasons. The first was that Lorenzo could not be forced to sell Eastern. He had picked up the airline for a song, and its net asset value, should it be liquidated, was nearly $3 billion. Lorenzo was thus in a position to ask an enormous price. Second, to meet this enormous price would require not only hundreds of millions in givebacks from the unions, but an enormous amount from their pension funds as well. ALPA and the flight attendants were willing to invest substantial amounts from their pension funds, but the machinists were not. So all efforts to displace Lorenzo through a white knight or an ESOP came to nothing. As we have seen, Lorenzo was really not interested in aviation. He was essentially a corporate raider and financial manipulator, more like his friend Michael Milken or his rival Carl Icahn, than he was like Bob Six or Eddie Rickenbacker. The daily details of actually running an airline held no charm for Lorenzo. Rather, the rush of the deal, the maneuvers, the ploys, the sharp advantage to be gained over an opponent was what attracted him. Lorenzo was so obsessed with beating labor that he never faced Eastern's real dilemmas. His employees had shown a willingness to do almost anything to keep their jobs and the company going. Lorenzo never saw that. Instead, he stripped Eastern and made off with millions in assets. Next time on Flying the Line, ALPA and Lorenzo maneuver for the high ground at Eastern Airlines. Thank you for listening. This has been Chapter 18, Part 2 of Flying the Line 2 by George E. Hopkins, Copyright 2000. We hope you have enjoyed this podcast. To listen and subscribe to more in this series, please check us out online at alpa.org or find us on all major podcast platforms. Until next time, this is the Flying the Line podcast, a look into the past of the Airline Pilots Association International. Production copyright ALPA 2024, all rights reserved.